Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Welcome back to New Books in Political Science, a podcast on the New Books Network. I'm Susan Lee Bell at St. Joseph's University, and today I'm joined by Dr. Catherine E. Harold, an associate professor at the Indiana University Lilly Family School of Philanthropy and a faculty affiliate of the Indiana University Paul H. O'Neill School of Public and Environmental Affairs. Catherine's written an engaging and important book entitled Delta Democracy: Pathways to Incremental Civic Revolution in Egypt and Beyond, published by Oxford University Press in 2020, and I'm delighted to welcome her to the New Books Network.
Thank you so much, Susan, for having me. It's an honor to be with you today.
So the 2011 Arab Spring protests seem to be a promising moment of democratization and liberalization. But the aftermath proved to be quite different with the outbreak of civil wars and the reemergence of authoritarian leaders. Delta Democracy argues that the public, those who make policy, and everyone in between need to look beyond the political action that captures headlines. And in your ethnographic research on Egypt's non-governmental organizations or NGOs, directs us to ongoing mobilization taking place at the grassroots level in civil society. Your extensive field research reveals the strategies that local NGOs use to cultivate democratic values and skills among everyday citizens. And you suggest that these strategies deployed by local NGOs may be more available and immediate than reforming national political institutions. The study not only increases our understanding of the grassroots mechanisms used to combat authoritarianism, it also serves as a playbook for U.S. policymakers as they make important decisions about the type of community organizations that they fund. And as you explain in the book, we might be surprised by which groups are helping make important changes in Egypt. Those normally not considered players in the political reform arena might actually be those doing the most work building the civil society that supports democratic reform. So before we dig into the findings of your remarkable book, I really enjoyed reading this. Let me ask you a bit about your professional life and training and how you came to write this book. You're working at the intersection of many fields. So tell me how you ended up in Egypt, talking to leaders of grant-making foundations and development NGOs.
You're right, Susan. I do work at the intersection of many fields, and that is partially a result of my interdisciplinary training. I hold a PhD in public policy that is grounded in political science, which means that I ask policy-relevant questions and frame those questions within comparative political science and international relations. But I also have a bachelor's in economics, and I've done master's level work in social policy and international business, that master's level work having been done in Europe. So I bring an international focus and a very interdisciplinary focus to the questions that I ask and the approaches that I take. But also important to note is that prior to earning my PhD, I spent about 5 years studying, working in, and consulting to U.S. philanthropic foundations. And I arrived at Duke to undertake PhD research with some really critical questions about the role of private philanthropy in a democratic society. I was familiar with a body of literature that suggested that private foundations are good for democracy because they bankroll a vibrant civil society. But I had seen behind the scenes and was skeptical. If we think about it, private philanthropy is made possible because of neoliberal economic policies that actually exacerbate wealth inequalities and allow the wealthy to amass more and more and more riches to give away. And I also saw that foundations are really anything but transparent, responsive, accountable to local citizens. So I really questioned this notion that private philanthropy is somehow great for democracy. But I didn't think that I could address that topic by studying foundations in the United States. They had emerged within and worked within an established democracy. And so teasing out their contribution to democracy, I felt would be really difficult. So I planned a comparative approach. I arrived at Duke in the public policy school with some really critical questions about the role of philanthropy and private philanthropic foundations in democracy. And it was my political science courses really that led me to focus on the Middle East.
Wow, that's a great story. Not all of it is in the introduction and in the acknowledgments, but some of it is. And I think that I can hear in the book you answering these questions, and it is that sort of sense of skepticism about the entire fit of private philanthropy within the system that is, it really makes you an incredible commentator on all of this. You conducted over 100 interviews with leaders of philanthropic foundations, development NGOs, human rights NGOs, activists, academics, leaders of international donor agencies, and you speak Arabic, but you did a lot of the interviews in English or using an Arabic translator. Explain a little bit about your interviewing, your sampling techniques, and the methodology that you used to write this book.
Sure. I spent about 2.5 years between the years of 2010 and 2017 in Egypt, conducting ethnographic field work, basically. I did conduct interviews, as you said. I also observed and participated in organizations' activities. I first arrived in Egypt in January of 2010, actually exactly 1 year before the 2011 Arab Spring uprisings. And at that point, my focus was primarily on local grant-making foundations that had emerged, contemporary foundations that had emerged since around 2002. I was curious, as I stated earlier, what these organizations' roles were in cultivating democracy. And I can talk a little bit about the theoretical framing of that separately. But during that early time in the field, I mainly spoke with leaders of local development organizations and their funders, those local Egyptian foundations. And it seemed very clear that these organizations were not, quote unquote, promoting democracy. But then the 2011 Arab Spring uprisings broke out. And so I quickly returned to the field and began speaking with a wide variety of leaders of civil society organizations. I circled back to those local foundations, the development NGOs that they were funding, as well as spoke with leaders of local human rights organizations, international NGOs, international donor agencies. I spoke with activists. I went to protests, always, of course, staying to the back because it wasn't my role to be protesting, but was there to observe. And I just spent, as I said, 2.5 years talking with as many people in Egypt's civil society sphere that I could. I mentioned the types of organizations that I did include in this study. It's also important to mention those that I didn't include. I did not include religious charities or Islamic NGOs. A number of scholars have written entire books on these organizations, and I excluded them because they tend, they are not typical recipients or seekers of democracy assistance or democracy aid or aid for democracy promotion. So this book really does focus on secular organizations, including local NGOs, international NGOs, and different types of donors.
And you're so clear about what you are doing and what others are doing. I very much appreciated that. But you're working in a country in which many of the people that you're interviewing might be worried. I mean, the state security apparatus is attentive to organizers. How did you balance that? How did you reassure your interviewees and contacts? You know, how did it affect your ability to do your research to be working in a regime that was undergoing such change?
I think this is where ethnography becomes even more important. You mentioned the issue of issues of security and also trust. So the bulk of my fieldwork occurred between early 2011 and mid to late 2012. And during this period, the context just rapidly changed. There was a period of euphoria, followed by a period of fear, intimidation, repression, etc. From the start, I had to work hard to earn the trust of my interlocutors. Under Mubarak, and then also after those 2011 Arab Spring uprisings during successive transitional governments, there was always a culture of fear that permeated Egypt's civil society sector because of the government's historic crackdowns on civil society. So to be asking questions related to the sector's role in promoting democratic political reform, this certainly had the potential to be very threatening to and dangerous for the organizations and the leaders with whom I was speaking. But by spending extensive time in Egypt, by using a process of snowball sampling, whereby I expanded my sample as interviewees suggested additional leaders within civil society to talk to, I was able to cultivate trust and move about in a relatively seamless way. As I mentioned, the context was rapidly changing, and this is where ethnography also served me well. I originally entered the field with a fairly robust interview protocol that I quickly threw out, because I realized that a lot of the questions I asked that I was asking were irrelevant, and also the questions I needed to be asking changed as the situation on the ground changed. The security situation required Adaptation, of course. There were rumors of blacklists of foreigners. My local friends told me that if I went to certain places, I would be kidnapped. I do recall a particularly memorable train trip to Minya, where I arrived. I was to call my my interlocutor when I arrived. We were going to meet under the Vodafone sign, and before she could arrive, the security services arrived to ask me a few questions. So it was a challenging time, but at the same time, anyone who knows Egypt and Egyptians also knows that Egyptians are some of the most warm and welcoming and helpful people on this earth. And so I really have to thank all of my interlocutors who did trust me and who did help me navigate the field during a very difficult political time.
So you mentioned changing your questions and your techniques. When you went to Egypt, you were trying to understand how philanthropic foundations operated in liberalized autocracies. But is Delta Democracy the book you intended to write before you began interviewing?
No. When I returned to Egypt in 2011, after my preliminary research in 2010, I expected that local Egyptian foundations and their development NGO grantees would not be players in the democracy promotion arena. My early conversations made it very clear that these organizations, and particularly the local foundations, were co-opted by the Mubarak regime. They were almost in bed with the Mubarak regime. One staff member of a local foundation described her organization as being in cahoots with the Mubarak regime. The leaders of these organizations were primarily business people who had profited from a system of crony capitalism through which they traded their philanthropy, which funded the types of socioeconomic development activities that were prioritized by the Mubarak regime, in exchange for business perks such as monopoly rights, kickbacks, contracts, etc. And so when the 2011 Arab Spring uprisings broke out, I really didn't expect that these organizations would quickly transform themselves into democracy brokers. And in fact, that's what I was... my early research in 2011 seemed to confirm that. As you noted, Susan, I said that I was asking the wrong questions. I was looking to see, when I went back just after those, just after Mubarak's deposal, I was looking to see if local foundations and development NGOs were engaging in the types of activities that we tend to think of when we think of quote unquote democracy promotion. Were they monitoring elections? Were they funding human rights protection? Were they trying to reform national political institutions, the legislature, the judiciary, etc.? And they weren't. And so therefore, I concluded early on that these organizations had just been so co-opted by Mubarak that they were either incapable of working to build democracy or that they were uninterested in bringing about democratic political reform. But as I continued my time in the field and as I spoke with more and more social change actors, I again realized that I was asking the wrong questions. First of all, the uprisings were not just about democracy. The uprisings were more broadly calls for human dignity, for political freedom, for social justice, for economic opportunity. And so by just asking about procedural democracy, I really wasn't asking relevant questions. The way that organizations were promoting democracy was very different from what I expected. the foundations, the NGOs did promote democracy, but they promoted a more substantive form of democracy than is typical of contemporary democracy promotion projects.
You've already done some of this, of kind of situating us in this culture of cronyism and connection with the philanthropic organizations. But I'm wondering if you can tell us a little bit more about the different types of groups that you were observing, how they approached reform, and what kind of participatory democratic practices that they were seeking to expand other than what you've said, the things we might expect, like let's reform the judiciary. Try to set the stage for us of how we distinguish among these different organizations.
I'm going to identify two primary buckets of organizations, and I'll explain which types of organizations are within each bucket. So on the one hand, there is a bucket of organizations that appeared to be at the front lines of democracy promotion in the wake of the 2011 uprisings. These include international donors, who many of whom were already in Egypt and increased their budgets for democracy building, and others of which quickly opened offices in Egypt because they perceived a political opportunity. So think USAID, the EU, various country embassies that provide funding for civil society, these major international donors. Okay, that was one type of organization in the, let's say, the democracy promotion establishment. Another type of organization, international NGOs that are specifically focused on democracy. So here we have organizations such as the National Endowment for Democracy, the National Democratic Institute, Freedom House, etc. Also in this group are local Egyptian human rights organizations. And there aren't so many of these, actually. The vast majority of NGOs in Egypt are not human rights organizations. Human rights NGOs are the few organizations in Egypt that actually take on issues related to politics and public policy. So these groups, the local human rights organizations, the international democracy NGOs, and the international donors were really at the front lines of democracy building in Egypt. And what did they do? They promoted a procedural form of democracy that, as I said earlier, focused on free and fair elections, representative legislators, independent judiciaries, independent media, etc. The other bucket of organizations, the ones that appeared on the surface to not respond to the uprisings, if, again, we think of the uprisings as a political opportunity for democracy, these organizations constitute a much larger sector of, or portion of Egypt's NGO sector. The local philanthropic foundations, the development NGOs, and also charitable groups and grassroots organizations. The local foundations, as I mentioned, were primarily established by business people to fund socioeconomic development NGOs. Those development NGOs worked primarily in fields such as education, job training, health, human services, arts and culture, et cetera. And then grassroots charitable organizations provided a variety of services for members of local communities. And again, these organizations, after the uprisings, remained squarely focused in the realm of socioeconomic development and charitable relief, and therefore, on the surface, appeared to squander what many perceived as this unprecedented political opportunity to promote democracy.
And as the story unfolds, are not doing that. They're doing something else. They're actually making these small changes that build the capacity for people to participate in democratic practices. They emphasize discussion and debate and collective problem solving, free expression, rights claiming are some of the things that you name. And then as I read this, I thought, is it more about democracy or is it more about liberalism is their focus? Like, it seems like we use that word democracy to mean so many things, but I'm a political theorist, so I can ask this question, but it really seems to be about the liberal part of liberal democracy that is their focus.
Precisely. And I often question whether the term should even be used in this book. And of course, it's in the title. It's scattered throughout the book.
And it has to be. It has to be, because if you want to speak to people other than political scientists, public policy experts, even all of those groups use this word. I mean, it's impossible. But the presidents don't. They use the language of democracy. So I think it makes sense that you are and that you're referring to it. And I don't mean to suggest otherwise. I just want to ask you, because I can, about how much of this is about democratic and how much is about liberal.
Oh, it's much more about liberal. And you're right. I do, in a sense, have to use that term, in part because I'm trying to reach the democracy promotion establishment, and we can talk about the policy implications later. But no, this time and again, my interlocutors said, well, it's about freedom. It's about liberalism. It's about human dignity. It's about the values that we often associate with quote unquote democracy, but it's not about democracy. And it's certainly not about the institutions of political democracy. It really is about freedom and justice at the civic level.
And this is my own pet peeve, but I actually think that we lack a language now, because the word liberal has been converted to mean, in public discourse, the left. So we have neoliberal, we have the left, but we actually don't, I think, have a very good term for having conversation about things like rule of law and rights that, again, that isn't technical and that can be understood across all of the audiences that your book is trying to reach. I actually want to ask you a little bit about the title. Which is, I'll remind everybody, Delta Democracy, Pathways to Incremental Civic Revolution in Egypt and Beyond. Can you talk a little bit about why you called this Delta Democracy?
Sure. The democracy building work of Egypt's development NGOs and local foundations was not meant to bring about a rapid transition to democracy. It was instead meant to coax the country more incrementally toward democratic political reform. And the Delta in Delta Democracy refers to this mode of change making. So Delta in mathematics represents a modicum of difference, hence the incremental. But the symbol for Delta resembles the pyramids of Giza, and also Egypt's population pools in the Nile River Delta. So that title is really a triple entendre.
So you note that as you're handing the book in for publication, and now, that Egypt remains under autocratic rule, but you say that the ongoing democracy building work of these local development NGOs and foundation deserves our attention. And just to really hit it, maybe you've already said much of this, but I'd like you to just focus on, so why is this topic so important? Like, why does this matter? Because I think it is so easy to dismiss this and not see the vast political implications and importance.
Let me speak to a few different levels of importance. First, the theoretical importance. Much of the literature on civil society in non-democratic contexts paints a pretty gloomy picture, that NGOs and civil society organizations are co-opted or controlled by to such a great extent by ruling regimes that they cannot serve to build, let's keep using the term democracy, but with the caveats that we've already discussed, that they can't serve to build democracy or cultivate democratic political reform. And not only that, that they actually serve to prop up autocracy, because we know that savvy autocrats use a variety of strategies to use NGOs to their advantage. So this paints, as I said, a pretty gloomy picture. But the case of Egypt shows that even under harsh political crackdowns, which we saw just increasingly harsh crackdowns through subsequent transitional regimes and now the current governing regime of Sisi, despite these crackdowns, despite this repression, civil society organizations do have some maneuverability thanks to their creativity, their resourcefulness, and their culturally resonant understandings of what quote unquote democracy means and how it can be promoted. So that's the theoretical contribution. There's also a policy contribution that US democracy assistance should be retooled to support this more subtle and incremental democracy building work. Democracy assistance has a poor track record, quite frankly, of bringing about democracy. And it's really come under fire for being incredibly technical and for circulating in a very small and elite milieu of organizations. So the ability of local NGOs to promote democracy, even after many of the democracy promotion organizations pulled out of Egypt, offers some lessons for the reform of U.S. democracy assistance. But then I think there's also a wider lesson here. We have seen, as you mentioned, in the past decade since the Arab Spring uprisings, resurgent authoritarianism, crackdowns on civil society in the Arab world and around the world. A number of non-democratic rulers have used the coronavirus crisis as an excuse for delimiting the space for civil society, for citizens to engage. Yet we continue to see, despite all of the challenges, we continue to see citizens coming together in the streets, conspicuously, but also in smaller, inconspicuous ways, coming together to build communities, to fight for values of freedom, of social justice, of economic equality and opportunity. And we see this across political contexts in non-democracies and democracies alike. And so the case of Egypt that's presented in the book is on the one hand specific, yet on the other hand, I think, really speaks to our current political reality.
Your findings seem to point towards changes in how the U.S. and other countries support democratization. And let's pretend for a minute that Joe Biden's foreign policy team listens to New Books in Political Science. What would be the policy prescriptions that emerge from your book such that the aid that is being given is more relevant and sustainable?
Well, I certainly expect that the transition team is listening to all of the networks in, or all of the channels in the New Books Network. But as for this one, if they are indeed listening and interested in reforming democracy assistance, let me lay out a few ideas. First, recognize that democracy and economics are tightly intertwined. When we talk about democracy, we need to talk not only about political reform, but also about economic and social justice. We need to talk more broadly about human dignity. So this means de-siloing grant-making budgets. Currently, international donors have budgets for democracy promotion and good governance, and separately, budgets and program areas for economic development, and specifically within that, program areas for education and job training and health. all of these different program areas, democracy building, education, health and human services, arts and culture, they're all intertwined. So can some of these grant-making silos be broken down? And maintaining a separate democracy promotion strategy not only disrespects how transformative change takes place, but it's also very dangerous for organizations to accept because it draws attention to the fact that they are working on democratic political reform. So de-silo grant making. Second, seek out new types of grantees. So much democracy assistance is actually given to international NGOs who are based in target countries. Some goes to local human rights organizations, but as the book shows, there's a much wider array of organizations that are working to build democracy at grassroots levels, development NGOs, local foundations, community philanthropies, etc. These should be eligible for grants that are related to democratic political reform. Third, reform application and reporting requirements. The application forms are so technical. They require organizations to structure their applications like business plans and to create logic models. Well, how do we build a logic model about, you know, building democracy? It shuts out so many grassroots organizations, locally embedded organizations, from being eligible for these grants in the first place. So while certain application and reporting procedures will always be there, particularly for federally funded donor agencies, can these agencies work more closely with local organizations to act as co-learners in the democracy building project? And fourth, drive values, not institutions. As I've mentioned, so much democracy assistance seeks to reform national political institutions and free and fair elections. And yet, around the world, citizens are calling for the values of democracy, but not for U.S. democratic institutions. And let's be frank, the U.S. democratic institutions have come under real pressure lately, and the U.S. has lost some standing to promote its democratic institutions. And so focusing more on the values that really resonate around the world could be helpful.
Thanks, Catherine. It's so interesting. This book has many audiences. It is an academic book that gives this sort of granular understanding of actions at the grassroots level and their impact. But it also has this very prescriptive outcome suggestions. Since the audience is so wide, I feel like this is an unfair question because the pandemic has made it very hard for authors to engage their audiences. But do you have a sense yet of what the response to the book has been from some of these audiences?
That's a great question, Susan. I have received feedback from folks in the policy establishment as well as scholars, but you know whose feedback I value most? And that is the feedback from my interlocutors throughout the Middle East. And the message of this book and the findings of this book have really resonated. I was nervous about publishing this book because, out of fear that it could endanger the organizations and the leaders with whom I spoke. And yet all of those leaders urged me to publish this book and said, please, this story must be told. We want your readers to understand the work that we are doing. And I find a similar response in my current field work in Palestine, where there's a very different fight. It's not about democracy, but the work of local social change actors and grassroots organizations is robust and needs to be valued and recognized for its significance locally and for its connection to what I mentioned earlier, those global social movements. I'll never forget a young woman with whom I was speaking in Palestine said, look, we have our own fight here, but we also feel connected despite all of the disconnections, right? We also feel connected to youth around the world who are taking to the streets for these values. And so I think that the message of the book that local people understand how to build change, and they should be leading these charges, not international donors. That's the message that seems to resonate.
No, and you do such a good job of showing the interrelationships. I want to make sure that all of the listeners get an understanding of everything that is in this remarkable book. And I will just say, I don't do this kind of work. I loved the book. It was very, very easy for me to read because the prose is beautiful and the explanations are clear and vocabulary is dealt with in such a sort of sophisticated yet non-insider way. So I just, I loved the writing and I want as many people as possible to read the book. So just to give a slight overview, so in the first chapter, you give this account of what Egypt's NGO sector looked like under Hosni Mubarak. And there, I think we really get this sort of powerful understanding of what happens in 30 years under autocratic rule. And you show how Egypt's NGO sector sort of works in that environment. And there's so much detail, but you've hit some of it, so I'm not going to push you on that. And then in chapter two, you talk about how the 2011 uprisings created these opportunities and challenges. And as you've already noted, you talk about these two sets of donors, the Western aid organizations and the Egyptian philanthropic organizations, and how they responded after Mubarak was removed. I want to ask you a little bit about chapter three, which focuses on how the Western democracy playbook, which you've also described, had these strengths and weaknesses. And well, actually, you know what? You've done that really well too. So let's do the two chapters I think were just the most amazing, which are chapters four and five. They present the strategies that were used by Egypt's philanthropic organizations, foundations, and development NGOs to build democracy. So could you just tell us a little bit more about the local quality, about the collaborative nature of this approach, and how it fared once Sisi was installed as president in 2014? And the government passed restrictions that really affected foundations' activities.
Absolutely. So the strategy of local organizations, and not all local organizations, let me stress here that I really am focused on Egypt's local philanthropic foundations, contemporary grant-making foundations, that is, and development NGOs. This is, it's not all NGOs in Egypt, but a subset. So the strategies that they used were marked by two key characteristics. Number one, they wove, quote unquote, democracy building into existing socioeconomic development projects. This respected the deeply intertwined nature of politics and economics in Egypt. Number two, they promoted, as I said earlier, this substantive form of democracy. And there were three levels at which this took place. Number one, through discussion, debate, and collective problem solving. We take many of these practices for granted in established democracy, coming together in a public sphere to discuss community needs and priorities and to work collectively to implement solutions. But these, in the words of Sheila Karapiko, a political scientist who has studied both democracy aid and specifically context within the Middle East, these, in her words, are brazen acts of insubordination in non-democratic contexts. So this was one level at which that substantive democracy materialized and was promoted through public discussion, debate, and problem solving. This also drew attention to government neglect, I should say. So number two was free expression. And this transpired largely, although not exclusively, through arts and culture. Arts and culture were everywhere after Mubarak's ouster. Graffiti in the streets, public arts and culture festivals where people came together to express themselves freely and express their visions for the future of Egypt, visions that citizens had really not had much control over in the past. So this also was very political. And of course, free expression being a critical underpinning of democracy and of liberal democracy. And then also rights claiming, understanding basic human rights, the right to high quality education, to high quality healthcare, to basic community infrastructure that was often lacking, and then to be able to go to local government officials and demand those rights. I want to point to another political scientist, Diana Fu, who has studied atomized mobilization and activism in the context of China, where NGOs coached local citizens to demand their rights to from local officials, but where the NGOs were really in the background. And here, NGOs, in the case of Egypt, were a bit more prominent in the facilitation process of those. And because these activities were always intertwined and interwoven into the socioeconomic development work that already existed and that was directly in line with government priorities, these organizations were able to persist even as the political environment just became more and more and more repressive. It started in late 2011 with the raids of international NGOs. There was the infamous NGO trial at which 43 NGO employees were put on trial and ultimately charged with operating organizations illegally. It just got worse and worse as human rights activists were slapped with travel bans and asset freezes. And it continues to this day. Just recently, three staff members of the Egyptian Initiative for Personal Rights were detained after meeting with some of their European counterparts. So the climate is just awful. And yet, as late as 2017, which was my last visit to the field, the development NGOs were persisting in cultivating democracy at grassroots levels.
I'm so glad you brought up Diana Fu's book for two reasons. First, I interviewed Diana this year. The book is, by the way, Mobilizing Without the Masses, Control and Contention in China. And it's a Cambridge University book from 2018. First, because it's really related, and also because I think that it reflects the kind of generous spirit that you have in the book and in the communication that you had with me in terms of acknowledging the work done by others. We're all together in this. And so I really appreciate you calling out Diana Fu. And I recommend that podcast to listeners. She was terrific. You've already mentioned that you're working in Palestine, but I wonder if you'd just say a little bit more about what your current research is on so we can look forward to it.
Oh, I'd be delighted to. Thank you. There's a fairly expansive literature on the NGOization of civil society in Palestine. That is the transformation of Palestine's civic sphere from one that was rooted in self-help groups, community organizing, social movements, et cetera, that undergirded the Intifada. But then with with the signing of the Oslo Accords and the influx of foreign aid to Palestine, we saw the rise of a very large, bureaucratic, and very lucrative NGO sector in Palestine. The highest paying jobs in Palestine tend to be those in the NGO sector.
Wow.
Yep. And these organizations were seen as marginalizing a culture of activism, a culture of volunteerism, because now one gets paid to volunteer in Palestine. If one volunteers, quote unquote, for an NGO, one expects pocket money and other sorts of perks. And my early research around 2015-16 confirmed this NGOization of the civic sphere. But everyone, and again, this illuminates the value of ethnography. Everyone with whom I spoke said, you know what? Yes, the foreign aid has been destructive, but you've got to talk to the youth because they are mobilizing in really innovative ways. They're creating these grassroots groups that are rejecting foreign funding and that are mobilizing large number of individuals around activities such as running, hiking, community yoga, arts and culture, charity, again, activities, farming, agriculture is a big one, activities that seem really just benign, yet have so much meaning in the Palestinian context when we think about rights claiming. And so those are the organizations that I, and the groups that that I'm currently studying, how, you know, the types of the activities that they're doing. I spend a lot of time hiking and running and farming. And but more importantly, not just the activities, but what do these activities mean in a struggle for liberation?
When you finish this work, you'll have to come back to New Books in Political Science. I know we could all fight over your interdisciplinary work, and maybe we'll find different hosts. But what a fantastic project that sounds like, and I can't wait to talk to you about it. I want to note that we're recording this on December 18th, 2020. And as you noted to me in an email, yesterday marked the 10th anniversary of the Tunisian uprisings and the Egyptian anniversary, 10-year anniversary, will be next month on January 25th. So it couldn't be a better time to read and think about your book and the issues that it raises. And I want to remind everybody that we've been talking to Catherine E. Harold. She's the author of Delta Democracy, Pathways to Incremental Civic Revolution in Egypt and Beyond. It's available on the Oxford University Press website through the ordinary channels, and we're encouraging people to use Bookshop, which supports brick and mortar bookstores. Catherine, thank you so much for taking the time to talk with me about your terrific book.
Thank you, Susan. It's been an honor and a really fun conversation.